are not able to be here this morning. They're out of the building this morning. Members and folks who are interested in this bill, here's how I'd like to proceed. As everybody knows, we've had some good testimony in the three divisions. Senator Thomasoni, your division, Senator Saxog, and then Senator Wieger has a couple of the accounts that have historically been in the legacy bill. And obviously have Senator Thomasoni and Senator Saxog as members of the Senate of the subcommittee, as well as Senator Ingebrigtsen, who was the author of the bill 2 years ago and has been on the conference committee previously. So how I would like to proceed is, and I think with all the discussion in this place, this bill is not going to be a huge surprise, but what I'd like to do is take some testimony with the subcommittee members who are present relative to some of the issues that either might be more contentious or involve a little bit more detail, but the broader areas without getting into individual accounts, but to have a broader exposition on some of these issues. When we're concluded, I'll pass out the proposed bill and spreadsheet to the committee members, and then have everything available for people to look at and walk out with. We won't take when we pass out the bills. That'll be the conclusion of the hearing. We'll reconvene after session. My hope is, I've talked to the Majority Leader's office, that the session will end early enough. We've got this big Senate gathering tonight. And the hope is the subcommittee will be finished with its work well in time to allow the subcommittee members to attend. The fly in the ointment is yesterday I learned that we've got our Senate fraternity composite photo tomorrow. And so we have to show up at 9 o'clock.
Looking good.
Yeah, well, yeah, as best we can.
Best
and so as a consequence, the Finance Committee can't meet tomorrow morning. So we will meet after session tomorrow to hopefully work on this bill. My intent tomorrow, because, again, there's been the opportunity for testimony and discussion in the divisions, and that's how I had always intended this. If somebody has something really spectacular to say, obviously let myself or more particularly let Nicole Kaplan know during the course of the day tomorrow. But the intent would not be to have extensive testimony tomorrow afternoon unless it's something that we just have not known about and it's something that needs to be brought to our attention. Would also indicate that there might be some small changes I'll propose in the spreadsheet between this morning and this afternoon. I don't think there'll be anything extensive. There won't be any reworking of, unless I just hear an uproar from somebody. I'm not sure when the bill will be on the floor. I think the original intent was to have the bill on the floor Monday. However, with the change in our schedule, I think Monday is now planned to be, Senator Dibble, I think your bill is going to be on the floor Monday, I believe.
I hear a rumor.
Pardon?
I hear a rumor.
Well, okay. And so I think just whatever side people are on, the import of the day will suggest that we probably don't do anything else, I'm guessing. But that's obviously something for the Majority Leader to determine. And so that we will then have the bill on the floor probably Tuesday, I would guess. But again, that's up to the Majority Leader. So that's kind of the schedule and how I'd like to proceed. Now, I will indicate to everyone else, most of the members of the subcommittee, and again, with so much going on, we've had some meetings. I've worked with Senator Ingebrigtsen on a number of these issues over the last couple of weeks, as well as working with individual members. So the members of the subcommittee have a pretty good idea of what's in the bill. And it won't contain any surprises for them.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Sorry, Fishbach.
Is it possible for us to get copies of the bill before we start the testimony? I mean, I saw it briefly yesterday, but by no means did I memorize the spreadsheet. And so, yes, you're saying that we're familiar with it, but not really.
Well, I think what's going on is they're finishing, putting the finishing touches on some of this stuff. Josh, if we can get, that's not a bad point. For at least the subcommittee members, let's see if we can get everything here. But I know we were trying to get everything put together. But, Josh, why don't you see if you can do that, at least, or Nicole, see if you can do that for subcommittee members. And, again, this will be available for everybody afterwards. But let me start with the testimony. Let me just indicate I've got several groupings of people, again, on some of these broader issues, in order, and because there are a couple of conflicts, we have some folks relative to the Minnesota State Arts Board. We will then have discussion of, I think, the Lessard Commission. Mr. Becker's here. Discussion of the clean water section and then the parks and trails section. So in essence, the four sections, obviously, as everybody knows, other than the arts part of it, the arts and culture part of it, we'll be dealing with what's basically the broad issues in the other three sections. There's not the time to deal with everything in the arts culture piece that's actually, to be real honest, a concern of mine. And I'll just say at the outset, if members will allow just a little bit of a speech before we begin. The legacy bill was put together in the Senate Finance Committee in 2005, 2006, continuing into 2007. As people are aware, the conference committee report did not quite pass at the end of the 2007 session, was redone the first part of 2008. Obviously, as everybody knows, many people here participated in the campaign of the fall of 2008. There were promises made to people throughout the state in requesting their vote in support of the amendment. That makes this a fairly unusual Senate finance bill, legislative finance bill, because not only is there a constitutional dedication of the monies, but it was derived from some very explicit campaign promises. And what I'm attempting to do with the bill, I hope to a large degree, is to fulfill those promises made to the 1.6 million people who vote for this thing. Coupled with that, when the bill was put together in the Finance Committee, I certainly had some idea of what my intent was in chairing the committee. And to be honest, being one of the people who, I won't say resurrected the constitutional amendment as it had begun, because there's no question what began the process were sportsmen in the state seeking habitat preservation. I don't think it's an unfair statement to suggest that that proposal was not going very far until the Senate Finance Committee took it up in 2005. That was on the heels of surfacing some of the ideas that were incorporated into this amendment in 2004, although the initial discussions took place between myself and a handful of people in 2003. And so I'm trying to reflect in this bill, and I know some people will have some disagreements, but I'm trying to reflect in this bill what I think the history and the intent was, both legislatively and in an electoral sense. So to kind of set that stage, the first group of people we have are several people representing the arts. I've got, and I'm not sure if we've got three chairs, so I've got four people. Sue Jens, Mark Turner, Kyle Carpenter, Larry Redman.
Mr. Chair.
Sarah Fishbach.
Mr. Chair, I'm just curious, if the public hasn't seen the bill, what are they testifying on?
They're going to be testifying on, I'll just tell you point blank, and I'm not going to distribute the bill until we're done with this testimony. They're going to be seeing, I think the arts folks are going to talk about their interest in why 50%, what the history of that is. Want to hear from Mr. Becker on some of what the commission has done and why the legislature should approve or not approve what the Lessard, Sam's commission has worked on. Obviously, the clean water piece has issues relative to clean water versus groundwater. I want to hear from some of the people who are most involved in that. And then an issue of clearly contention is the question of how we apportion the parks section. So that's how I want to proceed.
And so then, Mr. Chair, this afternoon, after session, we're going to be taking specific testimony on what's in the bill?
I'll take testimony if there is something of note that needs to be brought to the attention of the subcommittee. I don't intend to take testimony that would be an exposition of why what I'm trying to do is so great versus what somebody else is trying to do in terms of an individual account. We're not going to take that kind of testimony. That was done in the divisions.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I'm not on one of the divisions that dealt with those portions of the bill, and this is the first time that I've been on the committee that dealt with it, so I'm just trying to get a feel for
Senator Fischbach, that's explicitly why the divisions were given the authority and responsibility at the start of the session when this subcommittee was established to take the detailed testimony on the accounts. And then I, as you know, Senator Fischbach, I've spoken to every subcommittee member about interests they might have and have worked extensively with the division chairs relative to what kind of what they heard.
And, Mr. Okay. Chair, it's been – I just want to make sure that I understand how this process is going because we're a week and a half before the end of session. We've just seen the bill, and we're going to ram it through and make sure it's on the floor on Tuesday. And so I'm just curious what the process is and just making sure that the public knows, too.
Well, Senator Fischbach, I think you were here last night. I think I've tried to repress – part of the committee meeting.
Mr. Chair, yes, I know. Yes.
So I got a little bit derailed with some of what we've done in the Finance Committee. I first on the agenda, Sue Jens.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
I just think instead of leaving the term ram it through hanging in the air, I think you already made the point that most, if not all, of these provisions were heard in the Finance Divisions. So there's been quite a bit of public testimony on the elements of the bill.
Thanks, Senator Dibble, and that was the intent. And I let Senator Fischbach get away with her hyperbole because she's been giving me such a rough time the entire session.
Well, it has been fun to watch. It has been fun to sit here and watch silently.
Mr. Chair, if nothing else, we've entertained Senator Dibble for a portion of the – but, Mr. Chair, may I just ask then, so the arts portion was heard in a division?
Yeah, and Senator Saxogs.
Senator Saxogs. Okay, I'm just confirming. I just want to make sure.
Okay.
Thank you.
And I think, again, if you'd like the chairs, now Senator Wieger is not on the subcommittee, but only has a couple of the accounts. If you want Senator Saxog and Senator Tomasoni to reflect what was done in their division, I'm sure they'd be happy to do so.
And Mr. Chair, maybe I can ask Senator Tomasoni and Senator Saxog, is what's in the bill reflect exactly what came out of your committee? So there was no change. Thank you. I'm assuming nodding is what they're doing, so that's acknowledging that.
Those listening.
Yeah.
So if we can have Ms. Jens.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Sue Jens. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Arts Board. I have three colleagues with me who will introduce themselves as they make their brief remarks today. But on behalf of all of us, we do want to thank you for your time. We'd like to tell you a little bit about how we've invested legacy funds and also express our appreciation for your considering our request for an increase in investment for the 2014-15 biennium.
And Ms. Jones, just sorry for interrupting. What's in the bill and should not – what in the proposed bill and what should not be a surprise to anybody, I think I've talked to all the subcommittee members, is I talked about trying to maintain promises made to the electorate. One of the bases of the campaign, the arts culture section, was that the State Arts Board, the Regional Arts Councils, so not one representing whatever it is, I don't know, 1,300 organizations in the state, 1,200, whatever the number is, would be at 50% of that particular fund. So that's the particular issue I want to focus on.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick reminder, the Arts Board is a state agency. We've existed for more than a century. It's our job to stimulate and encourage the arts throughout the state. We have historically been the mechanism that the state has used to set priorities and allocate public resources in the arts. We're also the fiscal agent for the 11 regional arts councils, and Mark Turner will talk about that in just a moment. Together, our system comprises a way to deliver arts activities in all 87 counties. The system is rigorous and competitive. No individual, no organization is guaranteed funding. Processes, guidelines, review criteria are established and followed. It's also a citizen-driven and transparent process. We rely heavily on volunteers who review our applications, make grant recommendations, and they do that in a public session. So it's much like the process that you follow here at the legislature. We've given you a very brief handout that was we also shared with Senator Saxhog's committee earlier. And on the fourth page, it shows what our historic appropriation levels have been, the numbers of applications, the number of grants. The fiscal 13 column is blank since we're still in that year and we don't have final numbers. But the two things that I hope you'll take away from that page are about the demand. Before the Legacy Fund existed, we as a system received about 1,900 requests for funding. That's more than doubled. Last year it was more than 4,000 requests from across the state of Minnesota. On average, those requests total $50 million a year. And as a system, we're only able to accommodate about half of those requests, which is why our interest in seeing that investment increased, if that's possible. In the handout, we also give you on pages 5, 6, and 7 some examples of the programs and ways that we're investing legacy funds. The Arts Board is using them to invest in artists and arts organizations who are the backbone of our $11 billion nonprofit arts sector. But specifically, the legacy funds have allowed us to do some new things and to invest in ways that Minnesotans can engage in the arts that we couldn't do before. I'm going to quickly share just two of those with you, and you'll hear others from my colleagues at the table. Here are the two I wanted to share. One is a program that we funded with an organization called Kairos. It did a year-long set of arts activities in VA medical facilities. It provided dance, music, storytelling for veterans and their families. And according to the VA staff who worked with them, the individuals were chosen because they were the ones who most likely were spending their days watching television. That was what they were able to do. So the staff felt that this would be a powerful new experience for them, and it turned out to really be that it created bonds, it got people active and engaged. And in fact, one of the World War II veterans was able to share a very painful story of his experiences that he'd really been holding on to for about 50 years. But through this experience of storytelling, he was able to finally share that with others. Another example is the Minnesota Epilepsy Foundation. We funded a showcase of work featuring individuals who have epilepsy. Pardon me. There were dozens of individuals who were involved, and it ranged from a 70-year-old grandmother, a woman who runs a dairy farm, and even a junior high school Spanish teacher who had to give up his job because of the seizures he was experiencing. Each of the artists involved said that they gained a sense of control, a sense of confidence, and they knew that performance that they had been able to master would lead them to be more successful in their daily lives. These are two examples. There are thousands. There are actually tens of thousands if we looked at all of the things that are possible. So I want to leave you with one thought, and that is there are four of us at the table today, but really we represent the arts organizations. It's about 1,500, we think, arts organizations in the state of Minnesota, the 15,000 to 20,000 individual artists, the schools, the community centers, the youth programs, the health care facilities, the senior centers, the local communities and nonprofits that have summer programming in the arts or arts festivals. They don't come to you directly for legacy funds. They come to us. We're the primary access that they have to the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. I hope we've demonstrated that the demand is tremendous, but the possibilities of what we could do with increased support really are limitless. With that, I'll stop and hand off to my colleague, Mr. Turner.
Mr. Turner, if you could identify yourself, please.
Thank you, Sue. I'm Mark Turner. I'm the executive director of the Five Wings Regional Arts Council, which is located in Staples, Minnesota, and I'm currently the president of the Regional Arts Council Forum, which is a consortium of 11 regional arts councils around the state, which Sue had mentioned. I want to talk a little bit about the role of the regional arts councils. Like I mentioned and Sue had mentioned, there's 11 separate entities that cover all 87 counties in Minnesota, and we work in partnership with the State Arts Board to ensure that arts grants and arts development services are accessible all over the state, and in particular the smallest towns and rural areas. And I really think that's the strength of the regional arts council system, is that we're really a grassroots in nature. Each regional arts council is charged with tailoring its grant making and its grant program services to the individual needs and the unique needs of that particular region. And the key to that is really a simplistic beauty is that local constituents are in charge of each and have the authority to make decisions on the grant making and the program priorities. So it's really the constituents in that region making those local decisions, which I really feel is the strength of our system. Having said that, there are many similarities in Regional Arts Council programming across the state, and a lot of that is due to us really working together and talking with each other. I know, it sounds simplistic, but it really is efficient. We work together, constantly communicating with each other and the Minnesota State Arts Board. We work hard to share best practices, so there's a lot of similarities and things that really work across the state, but then realizing that some things don't work in southwest Minnesota, there's things that do work in arts development in northwest Minnesota. So we have those regional arts councils have the authority and have the aptitude to make those program changes, which, again, really speaks to the strength of the system. I'd like to say that we're in constant communication, that the left hand always knows what the right hand is doing, and I say that a little tongue-in-cheek, but I say that because we genuinely try to do that. We're working as a true partner and team in arts development across Minnesota. Things that the Regional Arts Councils do, Sue had provided a handout. It lists a lot of those examples, so I won't go into detail on those. But really all those things, community project grants, school residence grants, student mentorships, workshops, capacity building, all those things that really strengthen arts development across the whole state. But I think, again, as I mentioned, the key of the Regional Arts Council and the strength of the system is the ability of the local Regional Arts Council to have a close relationship with their constituents. Having that local office really means a lot, especially in greater Minnesota. I look across and I see Senator Ingebretson, and he can probably know that the folks in Hewitt, Minnesota, which he representative in previous years, really means a lot to them to have a local office to go to instead of coming to St. Paul, for example. So that really has a strength through the system. I see Regional Arts Councils as a truly accessible portal. For regular Minnesotans to have access to legacy funds and services, and we take a lot of pride in that. I have a couple examples I'll go through quickly. Like Sue said, there's literally thousands, if not 10,000s of examples in the last several years. But this one's most recently, I see it's actually in Senator Saxog's district. I see he's had to step out, but the small community of Pine River Bacchus, one example is bringing the Copper Street Brass Quintet to that school. It had a three-prong approach. It's exposed all students to the music of the Copper Street Brass Quintet. It also had a deeper experience for those students that had the inclination and the aptitude to go deeper into their art form, which they wouldn't have had otherwise. And also it exposed the whole community in a community performance that, if anyone's familiar with Pine River, it just simply wouldn't have happened without legacy funds. And that quintet would have never had the experience to be there, and those community members would never have that experience. On the other side of that is turning things internally. This is a great program that's actually going on right now in Cass Lake Bena, which is another small community up in Cass County. It's called, what's the name of it here? It's called Our Ancestors, and what it is, it's bringing students, families, community members, and elders in the community, because it's primarily a Native community, to produce an ethnic, culturally, and historically current artistic play about the community. And what that has done is really, it's already started to bring that community together in a really high quality of life way. And it's really been motivating, and there's a buzz in that town right now just because of that project. And when we talk about quality of life and what legacy dollars are doing, I really think that's hitting it right out of the park right there. Those are just a couple examples plucked out of the laundry list, literally 1,000 grants, like Sue had mentioned. But the problem is we're still only serving about 50% of that need and demand that's out there. So there's a lot of demand out there. I'm going to wrap up in short. I'm one of the many voters that voted for the legacy amendment, and these kind of dollars that goes to the State Arts Board and Regional Arts Council system are really, I feel, as one of those voters, where the money should be going. In short, the system is sound. It's worked for 30-plus years. I'm talking about the Regional Arts Council system. It's working better than ever, and now it's time to invest more. So there's a great momentum out there, and let's keep the ball rolling.
Okay, thank you.
Great. Good morning. My name is Kyle Carpenter. I'm the CEO of McPhail Center for Music, And for those of you who aren't familiar with McPhail, we are a 106-year-old homegrown Minnesota institution. And for the first time last year, our enrollment exceeded 10,000 students. We've made a concerted effort over the last 30 years to begin taking the teaching and our programs to the points of greatest need in our community and now to our state. McPhail serves every life stage with exceptional music learning experiences. Our youngest students are 6 weeks old, and our oldest student is 102 at this point. McPhail is looked to around the country by sister institutions as the innovator in the space. We were one of the first to have a Suzuki program right after World War II at McPhail. It's still one of the largest, certainly the largest in the Midwest. We began our early childhood music program 40 years ago. It's studied by other institutions around the country and around the world. We have 3,000 students in that program. We created a music therapy program to help people with traumatic brain disorders, Down syndrome, autism, using music as a way to break through. And we now have over 700 students in that program that we're serving. Most recently, we've instituted a Music for Life program, which is aimed at seniors and using music as a way to help them socialize and to express themselves. It's been a great success story for us, but by taking the programs to the people, I mean that we made a decision to extend our reach with additional sites. We have additional sites based in Apple Valley and White Bear Lake, in addition to our flagship facility in downtown Minneapolis. But beyond that, we've created 72 community partnerships in over 40 communities in and around the state. And again, this is where we take our programs and our teachers and put them on at the partner locations, places like the Whittier School, places like Ascension Academy, places like Lynn Blonston in St. Paul for a retirement community. And what we found is that the need is really great, and we've been able to address that need with programs that are efficient and effective, but we've now been able to move to a new level of innovation thanks to the Minnesota State Arts Board grant that we have in something that we call the McPhail Online School Partnerships. This is a case where we were able to take online infrastructure that existed in the Minnesota River Valley District connecting 8 different schools. These are places like Kirkhoven, Yellow Medicine, Wilmer, and we've been able to now use our 170 faculty members. These are teaching artists with master's degrees or higher largely in music and music performance, and we're able to provide kind of rifle shot opportunities into those school band, choir, and orchestra programs with exceptional music learning. As an example, Kirkhoven, Minnesota wanted to have a jazz program, a jazz band in their school. They have a nice band room. They have no one who understands how to teach a band jazz program. We have Greg Keel, one of our faculty members, who teaches them now once a week for an hour and a half. He plays with Aretha Franklin. He plays with Natalie Cole. And he's doing something great for those students. But what we're hearing is we're hearing the teacher that's left in that school, the lone music educator in that school, is saying, I'm learning more from these sessions than I could ever hope to learn any other way. I'm at the end of the supply line. I don't have anyone to turn to. And McPhail now, through these sessions, is helping me greatly. So this has been a terrific opportunity for us, especially as we consider that there are 30% fewer music educators in our public schools around the state of Minnesota today than there were 10 years ago. So this is one way we can supplement and augment. It's using existing infrastructure for fiber optics, and we've been able to connect into that with the great help of the Minnesota State Arts Board grants. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Redman, obviously you're known to all of us. I guess in particular what I want to hear, what I'd like to find out is the arts community has made a big deal this year of 50%. I know that's been the case in the past. I want to find out why. We should take that amount to the arts culture portion of this for the State Arts Board, the Regional Arts Councils.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. My name is Larry Redmond. I'm here today representing Minnesota Citizens for the Arts. Minnesota Citizens for the Arts is the field. We are all the arts organizations throughout the state, whether they're large or small, medium, rural, urban, suburban. We are also a citizen group of many, many thousands of organized people throughout the state who think this is important. I'm most definitely, Senator, going to come specifically to your, Mr. Chairman, your question. But if I may, I want to just say that you as the legislature did a very great thing when you put the legacy amendment on the ballot. And I think our people did an extraordinary thing in affirming that. Whether it's for the conservation of our land and water, or the preservation of our hunting traditions, or for the preservation and the expansion of our parks, and certainly for the development and enhancement of our arts and history of our state, it's an extraordinary thing when this happened. This is the only place in the country, perhaps in the world, where people have said that these matters are so important to the fiber of their lives, to their future, to their children's future, that we're going to enshrine it in the Constitution. And I don't think we should ever, in all these years that the legacy goes through, not constantly remind us of the profound significance of that act when it happens. So for all those people from the field who benefit from this, we thank you for your leadership in that particular role. The reason that the arts came forward a few years ago, asking to be part of this historic thing, was because of the fact that constantly over the few years, the arts, of course, are privately supported by and large, overwhelmingly supported by the private dollars. However, as our economy has changed, as the nature of ownership in our society has changed, it's become clear that if we were going to be able to continue with the artistic traditions that define a big part of the state, we were going to need some more help from the state government in that regard. For large organizations in the state, the amount of help that the state gives is about 2-3% of their operating budget. But 2-3% that was not there and is crucial for access and activities that have been described here today. For our smaller groups throughout the state, those dollars sometimes are larger percentages. Interestingly, our system actually favors the smaller systems as a percentage of their budgets. But that's because we're as committed to an organization that's 4 hours' drive from this building as we are to one that's 4 minutes' drive. We think that no matter where you live in this state, that's very, very important. But I think as we looked at those numbers and at those realities, and as we faced various budget cuts over the years, what became very, very clear was that when the state experienced shortfalls, the arts was one of the things that was first cut. And quite frankly, during various budget cuts, those cuts were substantially greater than other proportions. For instance, when the state faced a 14% shortage in its operating budget, the arts were cut 32% that year. And exacerbating that problem was that during times of prosperity, the recovery factor was much smaller. So we were actually going backwards. So the idea of being part of this constitutional amendment was key. When the legislature was deliberating on these matters, we did an extensive needs assessment throughout the state, covering every part of the state, to see what do we think the real need is out there. Without the state taking over the primary responsibility, the private sector will always be the primary responsible. But what is the level of money we need to have to sustain the kind of arts activity that all of us enjoy right now and build and enhance it? We worked on those numbers, and we presented very specific numbers at that time years ago. It happened that those numbers are roughly the equivalent of what would be now about 50% of the section that pertains to the arts and those dollars. But what we have also noticed is that as needs grow, that those can be eroded. So specifically, Senator Cohen and Mr. Chairman, in regard to your question, that the way we got to those numbers was by extensive needs assessment as to where we were at. But we're still not there. Ms. Jens and Mr. Turner have explained the fact that we're about 50% of the requests that are made. Now, we don't think every request that comes in necessarily ought to be funded. There is very, very tough panels that take a look at these, try to make sure that they're appropriate. But clearly we know that the lion's share of that is out there. We're not going to be there, even at the numbers that we request from you today. But that was the reason to get those numbers at that level. And frankly, because the very purpose of legacy is to guarantee some kind of sustaining and some kind of protection of this for future generations, we thought just as it was enshrined in the Constitution, it made sense to talk in some kind of a vocabulary in terms of the appropriation process of those numbers. Hence, we've come to that particular number and respectfully come forward with that request. I want to just finally say that the field, I'm not here representing the State Arts Board. I'm not here as a representative of your state agency. But the field strongly believes and supports your traditional system. By the way, the word traditional system is used in the constitutional language that you have. Years ago, as Ms. Jens pointed out, the state had the foresight to create an entity. And then sometime after that, before legacy was passed, we created a Minnesota Regional Arts Council system, which is the foremost system in the nation. We in Minnesota are kind of weak about bragging about ourselves sometimes. I think this is a day to do that. This is a system that the rest of the country admires. This is the model that is used for the rest of the country, because this system that you have through the State Arts Board and Regional Arts Council system covers every corner of the state. It covers every discipline. It recognizes that large organizations that reach hundreds of thousands of people need to be sustained, but on the same token, our smallest organizations have to be there to reach every possible person. This amendment is crucial to that. The ongoing support that is key to our future, and I think it's consistent with the very brave and courageous and visionary thing that this legislature did when they included the arts in the legacy bill. Thank you.
Okay. I have one quick question, Ms. Jens. You and I have talked about this before. With the legacy money, could you hazard a guess as to how many students are reached in one way or another around the state?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I can't hazard a guess. I know that I'll give you a little bit of background on it. All of the 150 organizations that receive operating support from the Arts Board must do education and outreach programs, and all of them are reaching thousands, tens of thousands, in the case of some of the larger organizations, hundreds of thousands of students. We have a special arts learning program. Many of the regional arts councils have arts learning programs that are reaching students as well. In our arts tour program, we expect that there will be education and outreach activities as well. So in nearly every one of our grant programs, and in most of the Regional Arts Council's grant programs, there is some component that either reaches students through the schools or reaches school-age students through some community activity.
Okay, thank you. Other questions for this panel? Okay, thank you very much. Next, would ask Mr. Becker for some testimony about the commission. And Mr. Becker, as you're approaching the table, maybe I should have specified a little bit more what I'd like to hear. In your instance, there's been some, I know, discussion. It's been in the press. It's been around this building. Some discussion relative to what the commission has done. I know in particular there are proposals relative to the metropolitan area and to the Fond du Lac reservation, which I don't think the commission has recommended. So a little bit about your process, and I think it would be a fair statement that, I hope I'm not putting words in your mouth, but that your position would be that what the legislature should do this year, insofar as the habitat part of the fund, is to incorporate the recommendations coming from the commission. And so I know those two proposals were excluded, and so I'm again wondering if I have been unfair, and if I've not been unfair in stating what I think your position might be, is to have you testify as to why that should be the case and why the exclusion of some of these other proposals.
Mr. Chair, Bill Becker, the Executive Director of the Lasard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council. I have my assistant, Ms. Coop, with me in case we get into numbers and things of that sort. The Lasard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council is a legislative body organized under statutes and the Fish and Game Statutes 97A.056. It's made up of 8 citizens and 4 legislators who have expertise and knowledge in the area of fish, game, wildlife habitats. We make funding recommendations that directly relate to the restoration, protection, and enhancement of wetlands, prairies, forests, and habitat for fish, game, and wildlife. and that prevent forest fragmentation, encourage forest consolidation, and expand restored native prairie. That's what the statute asks us to do. That's what the amendment asks us to do. Our objective is primarily to fund lasting projects, tangible things that 25 years from now can be around and viewed and benefit the public. I want to digress for just a second and recognize two members of the council who've sat through our deliberations who are on this subcommittee, Senator Ingebretson and Senator Saxog. Likewise, I'd like to express my regrets from Chair Hartwell, who's out of the country and wanted to be here. The council is staffed by nonpartisan joint services staff. We are staff to the council. We're staff to you as well. You're welcome to come to our offices and ask questions. We'll provide you what we know about the process and what's been before the council. The council has an open, competitive process for developing recommendations that creates a level playing field and is based on objective criteria. It's deliberated on program needs. In other words, we look to see for each program that comes before us what the needs are, what the capacity is. And part of our objective is to build capacity in conservation in Minnesota. We've invested in solid programs, that is, invested in things like scientific and natural areas, management and acquisition, aquatic management areas, wildlife management areas, and things of the sort. Our investments are based on a 25-year plan that was called for by the legislature and published in our second year, and state conservation plans. So we look to the LCMR plan, we look to the duck plan, we look to the pheasant plan to determine what the needs are and make sure that the programs that come before us are called for in those statewide plans. There's extensive council oversight through this process from the beginning of a reviewing an application that's a standard application, then reviewing an accomplishment plan to see what they intend to accomplish. By the time we've done all that, we're very familiar with the programs and able to allocate funds appropriately. Two things that you brought up, I think Metro and Fond du Lac are the two major issues that are on your mind. I'd like to address the Metro area first. There's been some contention that the council is biased against the metropolitan area. I don't think that's exactly the case. 10% of what we've recommended over the years, 40 out of $400 million, has gone to the metropolitan region. We've funded metropolitan parks. In fact, in the bill that you'll have before you, there are projects in metropolitan metro parks that are part of the parks and open space system. Our funding of metropolitan projects has been based on their habitat quality. Plain and simple. And sometimes it's difficult to determine whether or not a project is before the council because it's a habitat project or for some other reason. But the habitat projects tend to come to the fore. I think the question of hunting and fishing in the metropolitan area is overblown. Council members have a very sophisticated view of habitat and what it's for. By that, I mean they certainly are interested in the consumptive values, but the non-consumptive values are important to council members as well. The most sophisticated value for fish and wildlife, which is known as the option or existence value, I think is heartfelt by council members. That is, that what they want to do is to make sure that wildlife, the beneficiaries of these investments, the wildlife and fish, are around in for the future generations, whether they are consumed or used by them or not. Their very existence is of importance. So I don't think that there's an inherent bias toward the metropolitan area. I think some of the facts that control how much money is going into the metropolitan area are things like 3.5% of the state is in the metropolitan area. There's just more opportunity outside. It takes a concerted effort to move money into the metropolitan area because of that. 5% of the unprotected habitat's in the metropolitan area. 95% of it's outside the metropolitan area. Yet we're investing 10% of the money. So it may, to some people, appear not to be the right amount, and I'm not sure what is the right amount, but I know it's an amount that's been arrived at over time by people who understand wildlife and fish, understand human use of it, and what's necessary to provide a legacy of fish and wildlife for future generations. And that's what they're trying to do. The Fond du Lac issue, you want me to take questions on that now, or?
No, go ahead, Mr. Becker, whatever.
The Fond du Lac issue is the most complex issue I've ever dealt with in 35 years of state government. And I want to say right off the bat that my chair regrets the way it was handled. And specifically, in the course of evaluating that proposal, the council moved from its stated published criteria to the question of treaty rights, hunting and fishing, and how that affects land, public land in Minnesota, both banned land and other public land. We worked hard to try to mend relationships with the band. Chair Hartwell met with Ms. Diver to go over the situation with regard to the council. And the council adopted a statement in its call for proposals that prohibits the consideration of treaty hunting and fishing rights in the evaluation of projects before the council. I can't guarantee what will happen, but I am pretty sure the band will reapply. They've indicated that's their intention. And I think the council will have a spirited, level-headed, factual discussion of the project. It's a good project. It's to purchase land around a lake inside the reservation. Questions that have come up have to do with what banned land in BIA trust means and how the interests of the state are protected. I don't think that these are unanswerable questions. I think they're questions that take some research and some time to work out and a method to work out. I can't guarantee on reconsideration the council will recommend that particular project, but I will say without fact is the project was not adopted by a 7-5 vote, a very close vote. And there's a lot of flux in the council on that. I don't know what more to say about that project. It was a good project.
No, that's not, Mr. Becker, I don't think we're looking for a great detailed exposition. And in fact, Sarah Saxhawk, Sarah Ingebrigtsen are members of the commission and have talked to me about some of what's going on within the commission in regard to those two particular issues, as well as some of the general concerns and thoughts. So I just appreciate your perspective on that. Anything else that you think important to? I know you've spent, again, Senator Saxhawk is on the commission. You spent a lot of time with Senator Tomasoni's division. Anything else you think important to?
I'd like to just a brief summation.
Yes.
I think the commission, or the council, attempts to faithfully execute the constitutional amendment as best it can and as it understands it. There are 12 members on the council. There are 12 different views of what the constitutional amendment means. That's a good cross-section of Minnesota. I think it works well and serves the public well in making its recommendations. We understand that all our recommendations aren't always taken. We think the bulk of them are of high quality and wouldn't forward something to you if we didn't think it was a solid recommendation. The package before you was boarded on a 12-0 vote.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Becker. Questions, Mr. Becker? Thank you very much. The next issue I'd like to deal with is probably one of the more contentious issues, and that's the issue of the parks apportionment. I think the folks I have are, I think, former Senator Roebling, I believe, and delighted to have you. I know you've missed us a lot. And I've Brian Rice representing the Minneapolis Parks. I've got Bo Carlson from Three Rivers Park District, and I believe Al Liffert. Is that correct? What was the names I had, Mr. Liffert? If you want to. So the particular issue, and want to find out what the perspective of and I'm sorry, I apologize. I think Commissioner Meyer is here somewhere. I thought he was. Apparently not. I'd wanted somebody from the DNR. But the issue obviously I'd like to deal with is I think, again, not a secret to anybody who's followed this, that we have a proposal through the DNR commission that was set up in statute 2 years ago of 40% of the money going to the metropolitan parks, 40% to the state parks, 20% to the rural parks. One of the other proposals is, I think, some discussion that there was an agreement reached between some of the park systems that suggested 43% for the metropolitan parks, I believe 37% for the state parks, 20% for the rural parks. I hope I've not misstated that, but would like to find out why we should do one versus the other. So I'm not sure if we want to go in order from my left to right or the other direction, but whoever would like to start. Any volunteers? Mr. Meyer?
I can start for you here real quickly. Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources Commissioner's Office, and I do have copies of a letter that is signed by both Commissioner Landwehr, the Metropolitan Council Chair, and Greater Minnesota folks representing the governor's 40-40-20 proposal. And as that's handed out, I'll just briefly talk about it. In 2011, the commissioner or the legislature directed the department to convene and facilitate a working group of 9 members to develop consensus recommendations for the allocation of parks and trails funding. You'll see that citation quoted in the letter there towards the bottom. Basically, this group met over the interim. A lot of hard work and dedication was involved. The framework that was recommended was 40% for the Department of Natural Resources, 40% for the Metropolitan Regional Park and Trail Providers, and 20% for the Greater Minnesota Regional Park and Trail Providers. We did have testimony of this in Senator Tomasoni's committee and presented the findings of the work group. There was discussion of that. That is the governor's proposal. I know in discussions that are out there, people are looking at different funding allocations, and it's just important to remember that the Department of Natural Resources is the state of Minnesota's park system, the state park system. We represent all the citizens of the state of Minnesota. We do have a significant presence in the metropolitan area. For example, just Fort Snelling State Park has 900,000 visitors per year. So we do significant investments. The Browns Creek Trail is one example. Great Lake Trail, a system that's out there. And if you just compare the number of parks between the DNR, the Metropolitan Park System, and Greater Minnesota Park System, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources has 76 state park and rec areas, the Met Council 51, and Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails Coalition 126. We have four times as many acres to manage and maintain. Population that we represent is 5.3 million, all the citizens of the state of Minnesota versus the metropolitan or the outstate area. We have almost 5,000 campsites that we need to maintain compared to about a little over 200 within the metropolitan system and 4,500 in Greater Minnesota. Overnight usership, miles of trails. We have 620 miles of state paved trails that we try to maintain and take care of. So the metrics, I'm not even asking for more money. I'm just asking you to abide by the governor's recommendations and realize that the state system is a metropolitan and a Greater Minnesota system as well. Out of the top destinations, tourist destinations in Minnesota, state parks represent 32 of the top 50 metropolitan Minnesota tourist attractions, and we continue to be a national leader in providing top-quality outdoor recreation. As we look at our legacy investments, we look at four pillars that are out there, try to spread those around, leaving true legacy investments into our state park system that will be there for generations upon generations to enjoy after the 25 years is over. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Mayor, let me ask a quick question. One of the things that I don't think the legislature, and I certainly include myself in that regard, that we've not done a very good job of wrestling with relative to legacy money, and this doesn't apply to the parks section, but it'll center on the DNR a little bit, is the question of how much would go to public entities versus non-government entities. For instance, we had the folks relative to the arts. All those organizations are non-government organizations, so they have no other avenue other than in terms of public support. By contrast, we have several public entities that are receiving money, both significant dollars on a general fund basis. And to be fair, there's a general fund appropriation for the arts, for the science museum. But where we have state agencies or quasi-state agencies, notably the Minnesota Zoo, the Historical Society, and in particular the DNR, which is a total state agency, should we appropriate? I mean, this is kind of the question, you know, kind of begs the answer. Should we emphasize the non-state entities a little bit more as opposed to the state entities, where the DNR, as an agency of the state government, is clearly going to be in the state budget, clearly has, I don't know about an avenue to the governor's office, if that's an appropriate phrase, but as part of the governor's administration. Is that a distinction without a difference, or...
Mr. Chairman, members, I think when the legacy amendment was discussed, parks and trails of regional or statewide significance was a major component of that piece. And statewide significance is the park system. If you look at the DNR's overall budget, it declines or remains relatively flat, and those dollars we receive from the general fund or from the dollars that people pay to get in or buy things at are used for the day-to-day operations, making sure they're clean and secure, making sure the toilets are clean, making sure the showers are there. We have people there to do the work. The legacy dollars that we have are really to go above and beyond, provide additional outreach and education, provide for those unique and rare opportunities that, frankly, the state government, the legislature, just cannot afford to pay for sometimes. So I think the citizens of the state expected a portion of these parks and trails funds to go to the state park system. They certainly enjoy them and love them, and they are important to our outstate Minnesota and the metropolitan area's economy. So I think the legacy funding there should be a portion that comes to the state park system as well. In addition, the state park system has no opportunity to levy any other funds. We have no taxing authority. We cannot spend dollars any other place. We have to come to the legislature for those funds. So this is a true legacy event for us. We're leaving lasting, long-term, in many cases, perpetual investments for the citizens of the state of Minnesota to enjoy and relish. Also, I'm just going to have staff hand this out when they get a chance, too. It's a background of our state park system. There's a map in there, shows where all of our investments are. And on the back side, it talks about that budget, and there's that table with the metrics that I went through as well in there. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry.
Sir Ingram.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meyer, would you go through those real quickly, the amounts of parks that you have versus metro parks versus rural parks? You went through those quite quickly.
Mr. Chairman, it'll be in a table that's handing out to you, and I can get more copies for people as well. If you look at the number of parks and state rec areas that the state has, 67 state parks, 9 state rec areas. The metropolitan system is comprised of 51 parks, so there's approximately 50% more parks that are there in the state system. If you look at acres, the state park and rec area system is comprised of 225,000 acres compared to 50,000 within the Metropolitan Council and 46,000 in the Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails system currently. Our system supports the population of the entire state versus the Metropolitan or Greater Minnesota system. And if you look at the campsites and lodging, 4,777 campsites compared to 207 within the Metropolitan area and 4,570 in Greater Minnesota. So it's inside of that sheet that you're getting handed passed through right now.
Senator Saxhog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think Mr. Meyer brings up an important thing to remember with all four of these funds is that we're by law we cannot supplant expenses that we already have in government for these areas that we are funding. This indeed needs to be supplement. So it's important to recognize that, too.
Thank you. Mr. Rice.
thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Brian Rice. I'm representing the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board. And let me just give a very quick history, since there has been some backgrounds on history on this thing. Senator Lessard started this idea of dedicating one-eighth of the sales from existing sales tax for hunting and fishing. He tried to get that bill out of the Senate Environment Committee, and he was unsuccessful. I happened to be in his office that evening, and Senator Lessard was upset that his bill didn't move forward, but I suggested to him that if he would partner with park agencies, not just in the metro area, but in the state, he might be more successful. And within a couple days, we talked to Senator Anderson, Senator Jane Krentz, who was in the chair of that committee, Len Price, some other members. And in 1999, we got that bill out of that committee. And that really began a 10-year journey of getting a legacy amendment on the ballot. It evolved over time. It took a number of years. Senator Sams came in later and added water as a component to this legacy. That gave it more momentum. The idea then was not to take it out of existing tax, but to have it as an add-on. Because of Governor Pawlenty's resistance to the idea, it was not possible to get the governor to sign legislation that would have increased the sales tax. We made an effort to get it on the ballot, so it was a voter-sponsored initiative, or an initiative the voters would tax themselves for these projects. And I think ultimately what brought a great coalition together was the addition of the arts, which added a major component. But as the legislation evolved, I think a key part, at least with this, to the hunting and fishing part, in order to gain metro support, was the idea of parks, and along with the arts, along with water, along with some of these other basic functions. Senator Cohen, you recounted the history getting it through the legislature in 2008. I happened to serve on the steering committee of that body and was actually the president of the corporation that incorporated the legacy campaign in 2008. That title might sound more important than it is, but we did the legal work or worked on getting the legal work done. I was the chair of the corporation that lasted about a year and a half to do it. I also served as one of six or seven people that were on the steering committee for this initiative that included Mr. Redmond, Sheila Smith, Christine Almeida, Ken Martin, who is now the chair of the DFL party, David Hartwell, and I may be missing a couple of individuals. So I've had a fair degree of involvement with this legislation. As it comes to the parks part of this legislation, I do have a handout. I know it's been contentious. We're here today to ask the committee to consider a higher allocation than the one that the governor recommended. And I do have handouts for the committee. Thank you. There was work done pursuant to 2011 legislation and a task force that was formed to come up with a recommendation to the legislature. It's been styled as a consensus recommendation. It was members were appointed by three members from Greater Minnesota Regional Parks, three by the Commissioner of DNR, and three by the chair of the Met Council. The park agencies under the Met Council are 10 independent agencies consisting of the parts of the seven counties, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Bloomington, and Three Rivers. And I think I can fairly represent to the committee that nearly all of those entities do not support the governor's recommendation. We feel that it's inadequate given the facts when you look at park systems in Minnesota, where people live, who pays the sales tax to fund this legacy program, and the use that's done. And I think more importantly, in terms of the history of how these park dollars have been allocated, I'd like to call the committee's attention to the first page of the handout that I've provided. It's the green sheet. In the first biennial appropriation, the fiscal year 10-11 appropriation, Metro Parks received 43% of these legacy dollars. Senator Cohn, you chaired the conference committee on that. State parks received 43%. And there was a DNR grant program of 14% that was eligible to anyone in the state except the DNR, and it was available to the metropolitan agencies, and we received approximately about half of that 14%. So in the first biennium, the metropolitan area received about 50% of these funds. In the second biennium, the FY12-13 biennium, Senator Ingebretson, you chaired the conference committee. It was quite a contentious fight over the funding for Metro Parks, Regional Parks, Greater Minnesota Parks, and the final bill in that biennium wound up to be 42% for Metro Park, dedicated exclusively, 38% for DNR, and a new category was established for Greater Minnesota Parks of 20%. That was a very long, hard-fought battle. The bill did not pass in the regular session. It had to await action as one of the 12 bills that passed in the special session of 2011. And then this task force went to work, and I'll discuss that briefly. I want to be clear here today that our position from the Metro Parks would be a request that we get 43% of the money, DNR gets 37%, and Greater Minnesota Parks get 20%. So the extent that we're testifying, our issue is not with Greater Minnesota Regional Parks on this debate. The second page of the handout covers some statistics that Mr. Meyer covered, and I think we'd be in agreement with these numbers, but there are 51 metro regional parks serving 55% of the state's population. There are 75 state parks. Only three of those state parks, Fort Snelling, William O'Brien, and Afton, are located in the metropolitan area. The vast bulk of these parks are in Greater Minnesota. There are 128 potential parks in Greater Minnesota. That list is being refined, and hopefully there'll be legislation in the legacy bill to address their concerns about establishing a council and a framework. The third page of our document talks about operating budgets on an annual basis. Metro regional parks have an annual operating budget of $86 million. State parks is $56 million. We have an estimate for Greater Minnesota Parks at 10. 90% of the metro regional park budget comes from property taxes and fees and their part, and I'm looking at, actually in my handout, getting it ready, one of the important, on the last page I cover the population metrics, it's actually 54.3% in the metro area for population. When you look at this system, then, there are 54 total state or regional parks in the metropolitan area, 200 potentially in greater Minnesota. The sales tax revenue, 64% of the sales tax to fund legacy comes from the metropolitan area, 34% for greater Minnesota. I have the acreage numbers. But what perhaps is the biggest issue that we see in these parks is these metro parks are intensely used. We have 44 million user visits per year in these metro regional parks. And these metro parks aren't playgrounds or tot lots or swimming pools. They're large land areas in the metropolitan area, places like Como, Chain of Lakes, Minnehaha Park, Lake Billesby, Bunker Hills, a number of other parks. Their average size is at least 1,000 acres. They're natural resource based. They're for generally passive recreational activities. They do actually form up quite well with the state park system. And these metro regional parks have been recognized by the legislature. You set up a system in large part because the DNR simply does not serve the metro area. Despite Mr. Meyer's comments, it's true they have three parks and have trails. Their most used park in the metropolitan area is Fort Snelling, that has about 800,000 visits a year. I've heard the commissioner claim that it's like the eighth most used destination for parks. It's not even the 16th highest destination of regional parks in the metropolitan area. We have regional parks like Como that generate 3 or 4 million used visits a year. And the use of these regional parks by our population is significant. These parks are used on a multi-jurisdictional basis in order to be a regional park. Normally, at least 40% of the visitors do not come from the jurisdiction that pay 90% of the cost to run these systems. And out of the 44 million user visits, we have over 2 million visitors who come not from the metropolitan area but from greater Minnesota or from internationally, which is almost as much as what the DNR generates in their parks throughout the state. So these parks are huge assets to the metropolitan area. And what I'd like to do with these statistics is just call the committee's attention to two documents to give you a frame of reference on how the governor's recommendation was arrived at and how this 40-40-20 proposal came into being. I sat through each of the six meetings around the state of the committee that formed this, and the discussions were long and intense. It was difficult to get all the metrics. There were concerns about DNR user numbers, metro user numbers, numbers for this nascent greater Minnesota park system. There were some things that could be agreed on, like acres, numbers of parks, issues like that. But in the end, after these six meetings over 4 or 5 months, the DNR offered a proposal on how to divide this pot. And what they did is they came up with this theory. They said 80% of the money should be used for near-home visits. In other words, within people being able to reach a state or regional park within 30 minutes of their home in order to recreate. And they said 80% of that money should be set aside for that purpose. And then 20% should be used for destination issues and primarily tourism. And the assistant commissioner of DNR came up with this idea, threw out a meeting, and basically said on the 80% near at home, half should go to the metro area, because that's half the state, and half should go to greater Minnesota. And of that half to greater Minnesota, 25% should go to the DNR, and 25% should go to greater Minnesota parks. And this got blurred a little because the DNR said, well, we do have some parks in the metro area, but we'll just split it this way, you know, half to the metro, recognizing maybe there's some offset for the DNR in the metro population. And then they basically said 20% of the money should be used for tourism because our state parks clearly are a tourist attraction. We have wonderful state parks. The state park system started in the 1890s, about one of the second state park systems in the country. In fact, the first state park is in Minneapolis, Minnehaha State Park, and passed by the legislature in 1889. But tourism was a big factor, and so this is how you get the governor's proposal. That's the rationale. The second sheet is using the same rationale used in this, but actually applying some numbers to it. For example, if 80% of the money should go at near-home visits, how about recognizing that almost 55% of the state's population lives in the metropolitan area and has a desire to recreate in these areas? If you were to do that split and give the metro parks, use the 80 home near home, but apply a 55% factor, that would give metro parks 44% of the money right there, just using population, using the assistant commissioner of DNR's own idea on where these dollars should go. Using population as a measure to do it, we'd get 44%, and about 18% would be allocated to the DNR and Metro. And then on destination, DNR has 9 million user visits a year. About 55% of them come from Greater Minnesota, 45% come from Metro or outside of Greater Minnesota. So it's about 4 million visitors a year in DNR parks are not from Greater Minnesota. Tourists. Good number. They get all the money under the DNR governor's proposal. In the metropolitan area, we have 44 million user visits. Over 2 million of them come from Greater Minnesota into the metro to use our parks, and a significant number come from to go to places like Como and come in from outside the state. Using that division of resources, using the DNR's 80-20 split, the metropolitan area should get 50.66% of these dollars. DNR would get 31, and Greater Minnesota would get 18. Now, that's not our proposal, but I think that if you would seriously look at the numbers the way the DNR proposed, you would come up with a different result. So I just conclude by saying that we would like to see a bill that would have 43% to the metro area. It would reflect what nearly historically has been done the last two biennium. I think we can more than justify it based on the local effort that goes in from the metropolitan communities in the form of property tax and user fees. We can justify it in terms of the 64% of the sales tax that's raised in the metropolitan area. And I would ask this committee, as you're now considering all four aspects of this bill, to look at in its comprehensiveness, the $300 million that you allocate a year. Mr. Becker has testified that 90% of the LISAR dollars have gone to Greater Minnesota based on a number of considerations like where land is and where the availability is of natural resources. You haven't heard the water issue, but our research indicates that over 80% of all the money in the Clean Water Council dollars go to Greater Minnesota. I don't know the exact details of the arts area. I understand that's much more balanced, but I understand it's also a comprehensive program. And I'd come back to the beginning when I was in Senator Lessard's office. One way the legacy amendment got passed was there was a lot of cooperation between a lot of groups and a lot of different areas in the state. And I would submit to members of this legacy subdivision that one of the key linkages in keeping broad-based support for the entire legacy programs at the beginning was parks, and hopefully at the end would be that as well.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Rice. And I want to make sure we don't run out of time for the clean water folks. So, but I want to make sure we listen to the three of you. So, Senator Roebling, great to have you here. And
thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
You were a very valued member of the Finance Committee when I chaired it. I don't know if I was a valued member of the Finance Committee when you chaired it, but you'd have to you'd be the person to determine that. But great to have you back.
Thank you. I'm Claire Roebling. I'm the Communications and Legislative Coordinator for Scott County. And I just wanted to support what Mr. Rice has been talking about, in that we do have a large percent of the population of the state located in the metro area, and our metro parks are really important to us. It is so important, I believe, to have accessibility and affordability for this large metro population and anyone else who wants to come and visit. For example, Como Park is still a free park. Compare that to the Minnesota Zoo, where it's $18 for an adult to come in, and oftentimes it's so expensive that people may not go there, but they may choose Como Park instead. And I know I'm more than 30 miles from Como Park, but the people in my area actually do go there for frequent visits, which brings up the issue of destination parks. And I think that we probably do deserve some money If you use that formula for destination, because we do have those types of parks within the metro area, be it Como Park or the Chain of Lakes parks in St. Paul or Minneapolis, where many people even from my area also go and walk and enjoy the beauty around the lakes there. So I think that there are so many things, and it's so important to somehow connect the metro residents to nature and to wildlife, and even sometimes to farm life. For example, we have a Three Rivers Park that I take my granddaughter to for programming now that I have a little more time on my hands. And it's set up like a little farm, and the kids can actually have exposure to the little animals out there and seeing what they're growing. And I think this is so important. Just a couple of weeks ago, she held a little baby lamb, newborn lamb, on her lap and fed it with a bottle. And what a unique opportunity for city kids. And I think that it's so important to have those types of opportunities, because we need to have them have an understanding of agriculture. It benefits our whole state. The kids who live in the rural areas probably have opportunities to visit a farm on occasion, but there are many metro kids that will not have that opportunity unless we have facilities like this Gale Woods Farm out in Minnetrista to provide that. Also, just connections with nature. It's just so valuable. We have opportunities in our metro parks in my area for hunting and fishing. And again, we have to expose people in the metro area to that, especially our youth, so that we can continue this tradition in Minnesota that we have, and quite frankly, not end up with a lot of people who are anti-hunting. And I think if they have exposure to it and have opportunities, it certainly is going to allow us to continue politically even to have those sports and opportunities in our state. So I guess that's why we're asking you just to review that formula, make sure that center, that core population, where there's about 55% of the people living, have the adequate resources. And I love our state parks, I really do. But quite frankly, I don't get to visit them as often as I would like, partly because they're a little further away, and it's sometimes an affordability issue for families. But we really do make use of those metro parks, and that's why we have so many visits to them and want to make sure that we have the resources to maintain them.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Roebling. Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. My name is Bo Carlson. I'm the Associate Superintendent for Three Rivers Park District. And for the sake of time, I won't repeat a lot of the testimony that Mr. Rice or Senator Roebling provided, but I just wanted to connect a little bit on actually how we have spent the money and the consistency within the metro regional parks of identifying and trying to meet the goals of the long-range plan, the 25-year plan that has been put forth as part of the Parks and Trails Legacy Fund. And Mr. Meyer touched on that as well, of some of those key components that we're looking at. And they're those four pillars. And the first is connecting people to the outdoors. And as you've heard, we're trying to provide opportunities for people to recreate close to home. We have 53% of the population in the metro area. Having those recreational opportunities within 30 minutes of those homes is integral to get people out there to have the free time that they can get out and recreate within our system. Our system's very consistent with that. Again, with our visitation, you see the 44 million visits that we have within the system. That just reinforces that idea that people are looking for opportunities close to home where they can recreate. Second was acquiring land and creating opportunities. 10% of all the metro regional park money goes into a land acquisition fund. That creates opportunities for our outlying counties to buy property and secure areas for parkland or future parkland as we see growth even within the seven-county metro area. And we are seeing growth within those outlying counties. Counties like Scott, Anoka, Washington County, Carver County are all seeing population increases and the identification from those folks as they move in that they want to continue to have those recreational opportunities. Number three was taking care of what we have. And as was mentioned, we have parks within our system that are over 100 years old and in many cases being loved to death. Folks are coming out. We have a lot of visitation on a regular basis. We have infrastructure and facilities that are dated. In a lot of cases, we have parks that, because they were developed back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, we don't meet current code standards. We don't meet current accessibility standards, things that we want to do to upgrade to meet the demand and meet the audience that we're now trying to serve. And then finally, coordination among partners. And we within the metro system, amongst all our 10 agencies, We coordinate our projects. We ensure through the Metropolitan Council that we're not duplicating services. We try to ensure connectivity when it's dealing with our regional trail systems. We try to ensure that we're not duplicating the recreational opportunities within the system, that folks have a wide variety and a wide array of both natural areas within our park reserves and then more recreation-centered areas within our regional park system, as well as other unique opportunities that are addressed within our special recreation features that might be identifying and preserving those unique pieces of natural resource land or recreation opportunity that might be out there. So again, Mr. Chair, I won't repeat a lot of the details, but again, just support the position that's been presented regarding the Metro Regional Park System.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Carlson. And Mr. Liefert.
Thank you, Senator Cohen. My name is Al Liefert. I work as the park superintendent in Douglas County. I'll take just a minute to acknowledge Senator Tomasoni and the work that was done in earlier committees and to thank him for his efforts. And, of course, Senator Engelbretson represents the community that I live and work in, and so I appreciate his attendance at this hearing. The group of people that I represent are counties and cities around Minnesota that are not represented by the Metropolitan Planning Commissions, the Metropolitan Council. We certainly do not support the splits that have been talked about by the last three testifiers. We have worked hard with the committee of nine members in that of the 40-40-20 splits, we represent the 20%. No one was quite happy with that split, at least of all us. Nevertheless, we recognize that state parks are the vanguard of what is meant by parks in Minnesota. We aspire to be half as good as they are. We recognize the planning and the work and the investment that has gone into the metropolitan area over the past 35 years and the wonderful park agency that has been built down here as the result of that investment. But there is a very large contingent of Minnesota that does not live within the seven county areas, and nearly half the population lives out there. So we support the governor's recommendation reluctantly, but wholeheartedly. Thank you.
Mr. Chair. I thought he was done.
I wasn't quite done. No, we passed around an executive summary of a plan to use the 20% of the funds that would be allocated to Greater Minnesota. We think it's an excellent plan that will make sure that this investment follows the same rigorous rules that the rest of the state uses in connecting people to the outdoors, acquiring land, creating opportunities, taking care of the investments that counties and cities have made thus far and will continue to make. And we also have, you will notice in our executive summary and in the bill, I think, that was presented to you, that we're recommending that a commission be established through a governor's appointment that would provide for regional representation on the evaluation of projects as we move forward to ensure that all areas of Minnesota are served and that the counties and cities in four regions of Minnesota, we've broken it up into Northeast, Northwest, Central, and South, just because that's the DNR regions that we work with, that there will be local representation that has the opportunity to work through the projects to determine what is the appropriate use of money within the far reaches of this state and coordinate planning efforts of these counties and cities with the state park and trail network. It's very important that services are complement each other and are not necessarily duplicating each other's, and where appropriate, work with the Metropolitan Regional Park and open space areas on the counties and cities that border this population center. So a properly funded commission, we think, will be a great boon to the years going forward and to make sure that these funds are invested correctly and wisely. And so we appreciate your support for the bill that that Senator Tomasoni has helped us put together.
Thank you, Mr. Liefert. Questions, Senator Engelbretson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you all members.
Excuse me. I was asked. My name's Rick.
Yeah, can you wait till?
Sure.
If you want someone to say, we'll try to give you an opportunity. Sit down, please. Okay. Yeah, Senator Brisson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members that testified. I got a couple of questions. And first of all, I'll start with Mr. Rice, with your green document here. And looking at the history, that's been, I think, so eloquently testified, not only here but in the arts and humanities as well. But when you look at the first expenditure of 43-43-14, now, my knowledge is that 14% was not exclusively to the rural Minnesota at that time. I know that for a fact. In fact, I'm not sure if the DNR, as well as the Metro Parks, actually came in and used some of that money. And I think you had the authority to do that statutorily wise. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because I know the rural regional were not really set up and ready to go. And let's talk about that a little bit.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebretson, yes, in the first biennium, it was clear the amendment talked about parks of state and regional significance. And clearly, you know, state parks or DNR parks, regional parks at that point were primarily, if not exclusively, the metro system that this legislature established in 1974. And so the dollars in that 14% was set aside to basically model what the DNR had with their local grants program. The money was given to the DNR, but the legislation allowed only parks that were in greater Minnesota to apply for it, as well as metro regional parks. The DNR could not access that 14% of the money, although they administered the 14% of the money.
The follow-up question then would be, the DNR did not get any of that money. How much of that money did the Metro Parks get of that 14%?
Mr. Chairman, I believe of the 14%, we got approximately 5 or 6% of the 14% in terms of grants. There was, I believe, a small solar component that Representative Wagenius and Senator Anderson set aside, and a number of the grants that we got through that grant project came through solar grants. It would be fair to say that a significant majority of that 14% went to greater Minnesota parks that were not DNR parks, but greater Minnesota, what's now kind of known as greater Minnesota regional parks.
Mr. Chair, I do have a different number, and again, Mr. Rice talks about the struggles we had last time with percentages, and 11% of that 14% sticks in my mind. I don't know what that dollar figure comes out to be, but neither here nor there. The regional parks apparently at that time were not quite as ready for movement into the development of parks, and the last biennium, of course, we put 20% in there exclusively. Everybody knows that, so nobody else can come into that fund and actually take dollars out of there. But my next question would be to Mr. Liefert. Would you say that the rural parks area is still in the process of, in the process when you talk about state parks, metro parks, and regional parks just getting off the ground with their organization? How far ahead do you think you are compared to 3 years ago when this was passed, or 3 years ago when the first funding was?
Thank you, Senator Ingebretson. I think largely because of the work that was done in the last session, where you and the other committee members were able to allocate some exclusive funds to greater Minnesota for the first time, the splits in the grant program ran anywhere from 20% down to 5%, depending on how the years went. Of that 14% of the money that was in the grant program, sometimes 20% of it would go metro, sometimes 5% of it would go metro. It varied with projects. But because of the work that was done in the last session, there was some money allocated to continue planning and organizing the non-metropolitan regional park system. We, at that time, were in the very early stages of that organization. But we have spent the last year and a half working very hard to analyze and put together a system that I won't say that it's similar to the Metropolitan Council system. It serves the population and the subdivisions of government that are outside of that regional planning area, and it's pointed directly at their requirements and their needs. We think it is as good as the 2030 plan that Met Council has, but it certainly is not the same thing at all. It points at and answers questions and concerns for the regions of Minnesota that are outside of this population center. And everybody knows that there's an enormous difference between that 97.5% of this land area that's outside the metropolitan area. The Boundary Waters Canoe Area and the Blue Mound State Park of Worthington, I don't know how you could find a clearer example of what the difference in this state is, where sometimes 90% of the property in some of those northern counties that's already in public ownership. You get into the central parts of this state and there's heavy population centers, there's tremendous development pressure. And then you get down into the southern prairies, the southwest prairies of this state, there's a very low population, and yet there are tremendous resources to be protected down there. So we put together and think we have an excellent plan for how to allow those areas to determine how the 20% of legacy funds that are allocated to those parts of Minnesota will be spent properly. And that's the executive summary that was passed around.
Mr. Chair, and just one more follow-up if I yep. could. So do you think that eventually where it says unknown on the right-hand column, Greater Minnesota Regional Parks, those are going to be filled in with some numbers? Is there any way you're tracking the numbers of the visitorship? I believe it's on this document.
I'm not familiar with that document, and okay.
I think it was handed out by the DNR.
Okay.
And it's notably on there that you have, not a significant amount, but a certain amount more trails in greater Minnesota than they actually do in the Met Council. And I know this is
There's
contentious.
A lot of land out there.
It has been contentious over the years, and I know that's where certainly the income has, you can't argue with the amount of income that's come in the seven-county metro area. But, Mr. Chair, I don't think we're in a position to be doing anything as far as any amendments here or anything, but I still, you and I have had discussions, and I think you put together, a relatively good bill here, but I'm still concerned about the number 20, and I guess that can be talked about at a later date.
Okay. Well, thank you very much to the panel. Ms. Cablin's indicated to me there are a couple other people who have – I'm sorry, Sarah Robley.
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry.
There's a citizen here from Scott County who was hoping to talk – on the Lessard Sams portion, which we went into this portion before he had a chance, and I think he wanted just to address the issue that was raised about whether or not we were adequately addressing habitat in the metropolitan area.
Okay, and thank you, Senator Rubin. What I'd like to do is, I started to say Ms. Kaplan's indicated there were a couple of other people who wanted to testify. I'd like to have some discussion about the clean water section, and then where the couple of other folks have indicated an interest in testifying, listen to them when we're done with the clean water. So from whatever sections of the bill people wanted to testify to. So the only name I have on the list for the clean water section is Molly Peterson, but I know there's some other folks here. So Ms. Peterson, I don't know if there was anybody else. The issue in particular that I think important to talk about is the question of clean water versus groundwater. And so it looks like former Senator Morris is striding to the witness table. This is a day for former senators. And, so members, just keep that in mind.
It's easy
what,
on us.
What,
it's
we'll,
easy
on what we will be doing in a future life. So, Ms. Peterson.
Oh, Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Molly Peterson, the Government Affairs Director for Conservation Minnesota. And I think that the purpose for Conservation Minnesota being here to talk to you all today is to sum up in one word, groundwater. We recognize that groundwater sustainability is one of the greatest threats facing Minnesota over the next decade. And, you know, from Worthington to White Bear Lake, evidence is mounting that we are heading towards a crisis in both availability and in the quality of our groundwater. Aquifers are drying up, and the pressure is on to drain nearby lakes and rivers to meet our residential and commercial water demands. And as those water levels drop in aquifers, the contaminants that were previously detected at safe levels will be present in greater concentrations, and so that's going to impact human health. And so despite this, the state historically seems to not have been giving it the attention that it deserves, and that is also a part of why we're facing the crisis today. And so moving forward, we need a long-range vision and action plan to get us on track and protect our groundwater for future generations. And because of this, we believe that the Clean Water Fund recommendations should pay particular attention to groundwater for this funding cycle, perhaps more so in previous funding cycles, and maybe even more moving in future funding cycles. You know, when Minnesotans voted for the Clean Water Land and Legacy Amendment, it was because they saw all of the threats and challenges facing our natural resources. And so through our involvement in the 2008 campaign, we recognized that safe, reliable drinking water and groundwater protection was really a primary reason why the Minnesotans voted to raise our own taxes. So we are also mindful of the fact that we think that Minnesotans will react very favorably and very positively to paying particular attention to this issue this year. So I appreciate that. I will be brief. I see there are others to speak as well.
Thank you. So I'm not sure who's next.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rebecca Flood. I'm an assistant commissioner for water policy at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And I just want to make a couple of brief comments. The first is, as you mentioned in some of your opening remarks about clean water, in 2006, when the Clean Water Legacy Act was passed, one of the directives there in that act was to try to deliver money through existing programs and agencies as much as possible in order to be efficient and effective in delivery of programs. So when the constitutional amendment was passed, and then in 2008, the state agencies developed an interagency coordination team so that we could work together to make sure that we delivered that money from the constitutional amendment through programs in an efficient and effective manner. So with the development of our interagency coordination team, then we help develop the recommendations for the governor's recommendations. So if you have any specific questions about the governor's recommendations, we have members from the interagency coordination team here who can answer those questions for you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Morris, I just want to point out to the senators that when I mentioned the time I've been the senator, people chide me for the time I've been in the Senate. Sarah Morstein and I were elected the same year.
That's right. So. And that was quite some time ago, Mr. Chairman. Well,
that's what I was told as recently as last night on the floor. So.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for allowing a few minutes for some comments on particularly the Clean Water Fund portion of the Legacy Amendment. My name is Steve Morris. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Environmental Partnership. We are the state's largest coalition of environmental conservation groups with over 75 member organizations representing some hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans. And first of all, I want to say, amongst our members, we value the heritage money and the habitat and the land. We value the parks and participate in that funding. But today I'm here specifically to talk about the Clean Water Fund. As was indicated, it was one of the key components of getting the legacy amendment passed. I believe we did the only post-election polling in 2008 on this issue, and what we found is that more Minnesotans said they voted yes. Of those that voted yes, more people said they voted to protect our lakes, rivers, streams, and groundwater than all the other reasons they listed put together. It was the compelling issue that really drove Minnesotans to raise their taxes. That being said, I think it was only successful because of the large umbrella and the large coalition that was put forward, and I'm happy to see that coalition continues to work together. A couple of things I want to say about the recommendations of the Clean Water Fund. We believe, well, first, it's different than the other funds because it's programmatic in that it's not picking project by projects, as you're seeing in many of the other appropriations, particularly the Heritage Fund, but rather it was always thought of, we need to fund some core programs that have in place a system for protecting, cleaning up, and restoring our water, whether it be groundwater or surface water. We support the general framework that was brought forward by the Clean Water Council and in the governor's budget, and that is for our surface waters, we have a testing and planning cycle that we are investing considerable resources in on a 10-year cycle. We have an accountability bill that we hope will be part of this legislation also that Senator Hoffman is carrying to really beef that up to make sure it's really following through with the intention and the expectation of voters across all the funds to make sure that that money is effective. We believe that the restoration and protection strategies for surface waters are also very important. The grant money, for example, that goes to Bowser this year in the last biennium is about $40 million. In the last year, only about a quarter of the projects that were put forward were funded. We heard a little bit of discussion earlier about the arts and the contrast between the applications and the available money. In this area, we have about a quarter of the proposals that are put forward by local governments for local implementation are actually funded. So there's a great need there, and we realize we're short of money. So we do support that. We also would like to say that the groundwater protection does deserve more focus than it has in the past. As you may remember, Mr. Chairman, I authored the Groundwater Protection Act in 1989, and it's been something that's very important to me for a long time. And we have let our focus on that slip. We need to beef up support on the groundwater side, but we cannot do it at the expense of the surface water protection that we are moving forward with. A couple other specific areas I'd like to mention, septics. Something that we need to beef up and we haven't been doing enough on, and also Great Lakes restoration. We have a tremendous opportunity to match federal dollars for Great Lakes restoration, and we have a lot of activity going, particularly in the St. Louis estuary, to do major cleanup efforts. And my last point, Mr. Chairman, is a little bit more general with one specific example. We are increasingly concerned about the reluctance to use traditional sources of funding for some of the programs that are in the Clean Water Fund, and specifically I mean fees, whether it be some in the agricultural area or in other areas where it seems easier to go to the Clean Water Fund and use legacy dollars to run programs, even though traditionally, as the Constitution says, they're funded by fees. And the new example that we are concerned about that is in this bill this year is the inflow and infiltration money, which is a provision that is floating around, and I think it's in a bill from another body that has $500,000 to fund a study on how we deal with leaks in the sewer systems in cities that historically has been funded by fees. And our concern is that if we start substituting legacy money, contrary to the Constitution, for that type of work, we're setting a very bad precedent that could be very expensive down the road because that's a very expensive process. There's a lot of work that needs to be done there in future years. So we're very concerned about that precedent also across the entire hunting or across the entire conservation community.
Okay, thank you. And Ms. Flood, if I can ask, obviously the governor's proposal utilizes inappropriately so the state agencies. From your review of, say, the Clean Water Council recommendations, the work of Conservation Minnesota, do you have any significant objections to what they've proposed relative to legacy monies?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there are differences in certain portions of what the Clean Water Council recommends versus what the governor's recommendations are that could potentially have some significant impacts to particular programs. One I could highlight as an example would be the fact that the Clean Water Council recommends only $1 million for the development of and implementation of the Minnesota Agricultural Water Quality Certification Program versus the governor's recommendation of $3 million. They're trying to address the voluntary implementation of best management practices for specifically on farms for protection of water quality is a very important initiative for the governor, and we think that that is something where you get the most amount of pollution from agricultural runoff. Now there's been a lot of work and a lot of control of point sources of pollution and improvement in our receiving waters because of work at point sources, and now agricultural sources of pollution are primarily the largest sources in the state, and we're trying to develop voluntary programs to help get at that, and so we view this program as being very important for that effort.
Okay, thank you. Other questions from committee members? Well, thank you very much. Ms. Morse, did
Mr. Chairman, I do have a handout. I just wanted to leave with the committee.
Yes.
I'm not sure where you'd like those.
If you could do so. Thank you very much for testifying. As I indicated, there have been some other people who have indicated a desire to testify. Sir, I think you wanted to say something to the committee. Sir, this would be the appropriate time if you'd like to.
I am.
Well, if you can go to the table, identify yourself, please, and happy to listen. And if there's anybody else who, Ms. Kaplan indicated that there were some other folks who wish to testify. I don't have a list of names, so you know, why don't you just come up to the table and we'll just take folks in order. But, sir, if you could identify yourself and...
First I'd like to apologize. I don't know your protocol. It's the first time I've ever been here.
Oh, happy to have you here.
And it looked like the testimony was over, and I was asked by two members of the Metro Parks to come and testify, and I've already... And I didn't want to miss my opportunity to get my two cents in, so I apologize. I'm not a disrespectful person.
Nope, glad to have you here. Just right. Identify yourself and go
my
ahead.
My name is Rick Petrikovic. I'm a longtime resident of Scott County. I go back a long way with Lasard Sams. I was a volunteer with Partners for Change. I worked for years at several different outdoor shows, the Deer Classic, the Northwest Sports Show, the St. Paul Show, Game Fair. I talked to thousands upon thousands of people about that bill, the legacy bill, got them to sign the petition that put it on to a vote so it could be present. I'm not taking credit for it, but I do have some ownership in it. I'm also a volunteer with the Metro Parks. I'm a president of my local National Wild Turkey Federation chapter, the Dakota Strutters. We partnered with Metro Parks for several years. We sponsor a week-long turkey camp at Baker Park where this will be our fourth year. 30 youths get to go to a camp. They earn firearm safety. I teach them an advanced DNR turkey hunting clinic. They rock climb, they swim, they fish, they camp. They learn how to use a compass. And we provide scholarship dollars for youth from the inner city area to attend that camp. And last year, for the first year, any youth that wanted to, that had attended that camp, wanted to go turkey hunting, we persuaded Three Rivers Park to have a controlled hunt on their property. That never happened before. That is now expanded to four of the parks. We also do a disabled vet hunt. And so our relationship is really strong. And I don't want to be repetitive. We've already pounded the 50% of the people live here. But a little different spin on it is everybody doesn't have 3 hours to drive out state. Everybody doesn't have the financial funds to go and get in a car and pay for lodging. Three Rivers Parks is a unique opportunity. It's right here. And it's not just about consumptive use. That word was used before. The people that go into the parks can experience nature firsthand. Every one of their senses can touch it. And that's priceless. For somebody to be able to do that and not have to incur those expenses and time in financial investment, but you can't do it without habitat. If you don't invest adequate dollars in a habitat, those opportunities aren't going to be there. Habitat doesn't manage itself. I'm not a wildlife biologist, but you have to restore oak savannas. You have to clean the waters up. You have to take the chemicals out that we put in there. You need to restore native prairies so that that habitat can flourish. And I don't think the average person realizes how much of a gem that the Three Rivers Parks is. I'll give you an example of how it touches some people. We took 11 disabled vets hunting for the second year now on their park property. And I had a 91-year-old glider pilot from World War II, and he could outwalk me. That's not saying much, but he could walk. And he was talking and ranting and raving about the male cardinal in the tree above him that was signaling spring. That cardinal was dive-bombing my Jake decoy out in front of me. He was naming wood ducks and mallards that were flying overhead. There were sandhill cranes sounding off. 8 deer walked through the center of us. Rooster pheasants were crowing. Hopefully you can visualize it from what I'm describing. So there's a lot more to it than shooting an animal. Killing an animal is less than 10% of the hunting experience. Non-hunters don't understand that. So I just hope that you take the time to analyze the how many people you touch by managing the metro parks. And I'm not against state parks. I still go out and I enjoy them, but it doesn't have the potential to reach them every day like the metro parks. And I got a card once from a youth that I took on a youth hunt on a metro park, and the card very clearly stated to me, thanks very much for a beautiful experience. It was the best day of my life. Don't take that away from them.
Thank you. That's all I want to say. And sir, let me just ask if I might. So your testimony suggests that you'd be supportive of the proposal from the Metro Parks insofar as the percentage of dollars.
Habitat restoration
Okay.
is where it's at. And, yes, I am in support of what you just said. I'm sorry.
And I assume then in support of the recommendations from the Lessard Commission.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Sir Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, and thank you for that great testimony, and thank you for the work you've done on this. It's kind of interesting over the years and being on that committee since the day it was born. We've learned an awful lot about the wildlife and how it's changing in Minnesota. I had the opportunity to sit down with Bud Grant one time, and we talked about wild turkeys. And you know more about turkeys than I do, but he gave me a little 101 on where they used to be in Minnesota years ago and why they got to you didn't see any and why they're now starting to come back, and it was very interesting. You know, our whitetail population, too, has grown and come down. I think this year the Northwoods is going to find that the winter was pretty tough on them, but it goes up and down, and we have such tremendous opportunities. But the point where I'm going is that Minnesota really is changing, and managing animals is very important, and I know they do have management plans in the metro area, whether it's professionals, bow hunters or regular bow hunters, and because of overpopulation. So there's a lot more to the metro area when it comes to hunting and fishing opportunities than one would think, and I agree with that, hearing all the testimony on it. But thank you for your testimony. That was great.
You're welcome.
Okay, thank you for coming.
Yep.
And I saw, yep, just happy.
Thank you for the chance to speak. My name is Will Howell. I've been in and around politics for a long time. This is my first time testifying as well. I serve on the board of Kids Voting Minneapolis, and my reason for coming out today is, although I haven't seen the bill and will not be able to speak much to particulars, I had heard that the civic education money that has been included in previous legacy bills is perhaps not in this bill, and I guess I wanted to speak to you and implore you to find a way to put that money back in. When I came to Minnesota, 2004, I moved to this state. One of the things that struck me was the tremendous culture of civic activism here. And I mean civic in a bipartisan sense, in a multipartisan sense. The state is tremendous for that. And it's tremendous because of the many aspects and ways that's reinforced in the culture. And unfortunately, where it's traditionally been in the schools, it's getting cut back. With the kids with the legacy money that kids voting has gotten in previous years as part of the competitive grant process, we are currently working with a number of school districts around the state to help them start kids voting programs. And what we keep hearing from these districts at the local level is that they are finding it harder and harder and harder to work in civics education curriculum and lessons into their curriculum, that their local school boards are cutting it out. So the opportunity that exists with the legacy here, since the legacy amendment is about the culture of the state, you have an opportunity to say that civics has been part of the cultural heritage of the state and that civics education is worthy of funding with a very, very small chunk of the money that's set aside for arts and culture. So I just wanted to make my voice heard on that today, and I really, really appreciate the opportunity.
And I appreciate that. And you're correct in the bill that folks will see in a couple minutes. It's not there, but I want to make it clear that in the Senate budget, it is funded. And the thought was, and again, there have been discussions with the relevant committee chairman, that as an education program, there'd be more opportunity for arguably even enhancing the money, if not this year, but down the road, if that appropriation was carried in the K-12 bill, which obviously has a lot of the money is, whether the foundation aid formula or other parts of the bill are basically not touchable for other purposes, that there are more opportunities in that bill. So it is funded in the Senate. And the K-12 bill that passed off the floor whenever we did that a week ago or so has the same appropriation as has been carried in this bill. And there are some other places where that's happened in terms of what have been previously legacy jurisdictions. Okay. So it is funded, I can assure you.
And if it doesn't make it through conference, we hope you'll find a way.
Well, and that's a salient point. And what I've indicated relative to this bill vis-a-vis the some of these jurisdictional changes is that we'll be tracking those. And there'll be some determination, and folks who in this room who've been around here would have a sense, but certainly a number of people would not who are in the room, that when the House and the Senate pass their various finance bills, whether it be this bill or the omnibus finance bills, there are a number of jurisdictional differences in the bills. And one of the first things that our chief fiscal analysts do, Mr. Nauman, here in the Senate and Mr. Marks in the House, is they will sit down and align the jurisdictions, or not align them, but determine where the jurisdictional differences are. And then the leadership will determine what committee will resolve that issue. So I think folks can be assured that those monies will be tracking so that, in effect, if one body appropriates the money here, the other body someplace else, and the decision on the part of the leadership is to have that appropriation handled by the other conference committee, that money then, carries over. So where that's happening with this bill, I can assure you that those changes are being watched carefully. And the expectation, although, who knows with the state legislature occasionally, but the expectation is that nothing should fall through the cracks.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much.
Okay. All right, is there anybody else who, we're in session in a few minutes, but is there anybody else who has not been heard from? But members, as I said, we'll meet again after session. We'll have the opportunity to talk on the floor about what we've listened to this morning, review some of the documents that we've seen. A lot of this has been available to subcommittee members and particularly to the divisions with jurisdiction as well as myself over these last 2-3 months. We'll have the opportunity to talk about these issues as the day proceeds. And again, we'll meet, the subcommittee will meet after session. Hopefully, we will not be in session a long time. So for everybody in the room, obviously, you want to see what the proposal is to be presented. And so I'm not sure how we're going to – is Nicole – okay, so if everybody can just be patient, Ms. Kaplan will be back. We'll make sure we get out of the room in plenty of time. So thank you very much for coming, and thank you very much for the testimony.